From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll talk with a chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times about how his work has changed during the Trump administration. Then NPR's White Lies podcast takes a deep look into the unsolved murder of civil rights activist, the Reverend James Reeb.
The window on all these old civil rights cold cases is closing, or maybe has closed, in terms of getting the truth from people who were participants or who witnessed these things. And so, we really felt that the urge to get the people that we knew had some access to the story to tell us the truth.
And Milwaukee filmmaker Tracy Thomas made her first film in her 60s. She reflects on getting older.
If you are constantly thinking about the number, whatever age you are, you're going to be locked into that. And we tend to think, hey, 60, 70, we're old, and yeah, life's over. Well, you can certainly think that. I think it's what you do with that time.
Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. Listening to Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Bonnie North. The press has always had a somewhat combative relationship with politicians, but in the last few years, things have felt different. What was once a Cold War of sorts has seemingly turned into an all-out brawl, with the President of the United States leading the charge against the Fourth Estate. Carl Hulse may know this better than anyone. As a reporter, he spent more than 30 years covering politics in D.C., which includes 6 presidential administrations. Hulse was in town for an event at the Marquette Law School, and he stopped by the studio to talk with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
You've been in Washington, D.C. since the mid-80s.
Correct.
A lot of us, especially out here, we look at the Trump presidency as a kind of anomaly. But when you compare it to previous administrations, which you've covered, how does it stack up?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because I used to say that sort of one of the most disorienting days I'd ever covered in Washington was in 1998, when the House was impeaching Bill Clinton. And there was a Saturday, a very wild day in the House. Folks might not remember, but the person, Robert Livingston, who was coming in to be Speaker, he had to resign right on the House floor over some sexual misconduct. We were bombing in the Middle East. All this, there was a fight between lawmakers in the Speaker's lobby. And I used to say that was sort of the most discombobulating day until last week, because that was the back-to-back, the showdown at the White House between the president and Nancy Pelosi. Never seen anything like that before. Mick Mulvaney coming out and then pretty much announcing what the Democrats were saying was an impeachable offense, announcing that the president was going to have the G7 next year at his own resort. Everybody went, well, this is a new high or low, whichever way you want to do it. And it was also oddly on the president's 1,000th day in office, which is sort of a marker too. So this is very unusual. We're in a different time. I've seen a lot of things go on there, but I haven't seen things like we're seeing right now. So it's an anomaly in some way, and I don't know if it's a precursor of how people are going to function in the future, but it's definitely different.
When you look at Trump as a president in general, how does he function compare him to other Republican presidents? How does he function compared to, say, George W., George H.W.?
Yeah. Now, it's funny. Some people like to refer to organized chaos. I say about Trump, disorganized chaos. And you can say a lot about George W. Bush's policies and the impact they had worldwide, but they ran a very typical, traditional, professional, business-like Republican White House. George H.W. Bush or Ronald Reagan, in some ways, even more so. They wanted to approach it in a business-like manner. Now we have a businessman in there, and he approaches it totally differently. It is really seems like seat of the pants all the time, not very well planned out. I mean, he conducts his policy by Twitter. And I think he said at that debate rally last week, I don't want to be presidential. That's boring. I want to be me. So he sort of welcomes this as his way of doing business and keeping his opponents off kilter, but I think it's jarring to a lot of people. And I think the Syria policy, so here you have a real piece of foreign policy. It's one thing to be tweeting insults at your opponents, but the Syria-Turkey policy, this was a major moment for a break with the Republicans. They have invested a lot of time and effort in this. They think they know more about it than Trump does. And for him to do that, it's really set off a chain reaction. But it's a totally different way of doing business. And the media is – we're learning to do our business differently too. So it's kind of a collision there for sure.
Yeah. I mean, you know, more than 30 years in D.C., you've been reporting on – not just presidents, but you've been reporting on a lot of politics inside of D.C. How has reporting on these things changed?
Yeah, it's a totally different business. My first job was in LaSalle, Illinois, not too far from here. And, you know, we typed on manual typewriters and used carbons and, you know, literally cut and paste. None of all that's gone. And it's just a... you know, for somebody in the news business, I say, wow, there's just too much news. We've got so much going on every day. You can't really keep up. You've barely absorbed one fact, then you're on to the other. And the president wants that to happen. He wants distractions. He wants everybody moving past the last scandal and outrage to the next one. And so it's very different. It's 24-hour. We're also subjected to a lot of social media criticism. You know, working at the New York Times, you're always subject to criticism. We're highly scrutinized. But, you know, now everybody can just weigh in on you, and it can be pretty rough. So, and the partisanship and the divide is much bigger. And I've somebody who's been there a long time and know people in both parties and deal with people in both parties. But they're now, you know, you can get in arguments with the people you're covering. It can be pretty tough. I noticed there was an argument going on Twitter today between a reporter and a senator from Missouri who were sort of going after each other on Twitter. That kind of thing didn't used to happen at all. So it's tough, but yeah, this is what we do, and it's we're trying to do the best we can. There's a lot of people who want the Times to be the resistance, and as the Dean Baquet, the editor, says, and Marty Baron at the Post, they both said, we're just going to keep doing our jobs, and we're doing them to the best of our ability and try and be fair and cover the news. But there's a lot of things that are going on now that certainly didn't happen when I first started as a reporter.
Well, and I think it becomes difficult when you have the president specifically calling out your newspaper, calling out the New York Times, not just saying that you're fake news, but saying
the enemy
that—
of the people.
Yeah.
It's a real thing. We've had to make new security arrangements in our office in Washington. I don't think outside the president and, you know, a lot on the real conservative right, that's not a message that breaks through with the rest of Washington or on Capitol Hill and Congress. I spend a lot of time in the Capitol covering the House and the Senate. Nobody up there thinks we're the enemy of the people. Or fake news, for that matter. I mean, there's still a lot of people who want to talk to me because of the credibility of the New York Times. But it creates a difficult environment, and reporters get a lot of really nasty tweets sent at them, direct messages, all that sort of thing. And you want to let it roll off of you. It's probably easier for me to let it roll off because I've been around a long time. But I think it's harder for some of the younger people. I saw today he was talking about, you know, banning the Times and the Post from the White House. I don't know if he actually meant the printed paper or not, the way he worded that. But Donald Trump also wants the New York Times to embrace him. He wants the validation of the New York Times. He's a guy from the boroughs of New York, and the Times is the establishment press to him in New York. So it's a strange relationship. You remember after he got elected, he came over to the office for a meeting with the Times. So some of that's just his typical bravado.
Well, and inside of that bravado, you know, you talked about policy by tweet, but part of what we see from him is people who were a couple weeks before his best friend, you know, Lindsey Graham was, you know, a top politician, one of the best guys in Washington. Immediately, once there's any kind of criticism, they become his enemy.
Yeah, he punched back a little bit on Lindsey over the Syria thing. But Lindsey Graham, and he's obviously, I talk to Lindsey fairly frequently, and he obviously saw the way to try and influence the president and push him in the direction that he wanted is to maintain a relationship with him and work with him. And it's kind of weird because Lindsey Graham also, you know, said terrible things about him during the campaign. But on the Syria thing, it was just too far for him. This is real life. This is people on the ground over there. This is our allies. This is our standing in the world. He wasn't going to be quiet for that. But I noticed, you know, this morning the president said he's being lynched, a loaded word in his impeachment process. A lot of pushback that, including notably Bobby Rush, congressman from Illinois, called on him to, African-American congressman called on him to take down the tweet. Of course, Trump will never do that. But Lindsey Graham defended him on that. And it's like, well, I don't know if that's a good thing that Lindsey Graham wants to get involved in. He needs African-American voters in South Carolina. And so, you know, there's a bifurcation. Well, we're angry with him on Syria, but we're sticking with him on impeachment and things like this. Although I do think on the impeachment it has an impact because some Republicans are just going to say it's too much. It's too much. As this impeachment goes forward, do I really want to stand up there every day and defend the president? And I think some of them will decide, you know what, I'm just not going to do it anymore. The thing with the resort was a step too far for a lot of Republicans.
And kind of to the point of when they'll stand up and when they won't. You know, you said the idea of fake news. While it might be coming out of the president's mouth, it's not necessarily something that permeates the culture in D.C. But from the outside looking in, it does feel as though there's this combative relationship, specifically with the GOP and journalists. And they haven't – there hasn't been a lot of pushback to this idea of – journalists being quote-unquote fake news?
Yeah, I think you're right on that. I think you're right on everything you just said. It's not – it doesn't take over D.C., but they – I think people could speak out more, Republicans, certainly on the fake news aspect. Instead, a lot of them adopted as a joke, ha-ha, fake news. Yeah, I would like to see more there, but I'm not counting on it. But it is combative, certainly between our people who cover the White House regularly and the administration. And it's less combative on Capitol Hill, but in the farther conservative members are is probably where the more combat's going to come from. There's more between us and the people in the House and the people in the Senate. So yeah, it's tricky to navigate, and there are differences. And you're right, the members don't push back enough on that.
Taking kind of a left turn, you know, something we keep hearing from the national press, we're looking at having the DNC here in Milwaukee, but a lot of people are saying that Wisconsin is the state to watch in general this next election.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. You are prime time here. This is going to be the biggest battleground in the country, I think, right now. There's a lot of reasons for that. I think Wisconsin is still seen as up in the air compared to, say, I mean, the big states that people are going to watch from the last time because of what happened, Pennsylvania and Michigan. Pennsylvania and Michigan seem a little different from Wisconsin right now. I think the Democratic parties in those states went and said, boy, this was a huge mistake. We weren't ready for this. The Republican Party in Pennsylvania is having some trouble. I think people see those two states as less of a battleground than Wisconsin. And then you're going to have the convention here, which, by the way, is going to be very exciting for all you guys, but it's going to be very inconvenient. I mean, the conventions are a big thing and, you know, there'll be roads shut down. But I think you'll all really enjoy having that here just for the spectacle that it is. But you're just going to be bombarded. I mean, the you know, people have discovered the Electoral College for the first time in my lifetime. Well, wait, how does this work? And you're the one that the Republicans still think they have a very strong chance at, better than some of the other states that helped Trump the last time. So it's going to be – you're going to see a lot of TV ads.
Well, it's a very split state when you look at most elections.
Or your two senators.
Or our two senators, yeah. If you look at our two senators, but if you even look at, you know, our gubernatorial race last time – just over the threshold to have a recall.
Yeah, so it's all about – this is going to be all – you know, we have a big joke in Washington. It's all about turnout. Well, here it is actually going to be all about turnout. Who's going to get their people out? But I also think suburban women are the group to watch. That in Wisconsin, from my knowledge of the election back then – and I paid fairly close attention – Trump was able to hold on to significant numbers of white women in the suburbs. And as we've gone through these past few years, that's the group that he has struggled to hold on to. And that was what flip the House, basically, to the Democrats. So I think what happens in this state is going to be a lot of focus on women and getting people to vote and then getting minorities to vote in bigger numbers than they voted the last time. But it's going to be something in Wisconsin. You guys are probably going to be very sick of the presidential election by the time it's actually held.
Some people are already
sick
of it.
Yeah, well, it's going to be way worse than that.
You know, partisanship has become kind of the word of the day, regardless of what we're talking about in politics. But even our court system has become very partisan. You actually wrote a book about this.
Yeah, I wrote a whole book about the politicization of the courts. That's what I'm in town for. I've been doing some talks at the Marquette Law School. So what has happened is, and my book goes back to Merrick Garland and the decision by Mitch McConnell to block Obama from filling that vacancy from Antonin Scalia, and then the rollout effect that had on so many different things. And I mean, that McConnell's decision literally changed American history, I argue in my book, because that vacancy and everything that came after, and you remember Trump's list, and that really helped Trump win the election because it helped conservatives and evangelicals have something to rally behind Trump on. And then he was able to install two justices. And what's kind of happened in I actually talk a little bit in my book about some Wisconsin incidents, too, if people want to look at that. But what's happened is our politics are so polarized and partisan that the courts have become the arbiters of our politics and our policy. So who you get on the courts now and what president nominates and confirms them has become this huge fight. So every new judicial vacancy creates this stir on the Supreme Court. There have been a lot of rules changes in the Senate to let either party push through their nominees. So the partisanship that's marked our politics for the past 20 years has really spread to the courts now and threatened their legitimacy.
The book is called Confirmation Bias. And what are the logical repercussions of this partisanship?
Well, I think people lose confidence in the courts. Marquette had a poll that was out yesterday showed the court wasn't in terrible shape with the public right now, but it did show a few other things that people want. A majority support in that poll said Supreme Court justices should be term limited, a significant majority. That's a big change. Not quite under majority, although a sizable number said we should add seats to the court to offset some of these appointments by President Trump. So you have the court, people calling for change. I think you're going to hear a lot about it from Democratic presidential candidates. You saw it in the last debate. Some are supporting term limits. Some are supporting additional numbers. So the court is going to loom as a big issue in the campaign. But more importantly, the Supreme Court doesn't have an army or anything to enforce its rulings. It sort of it needs the goodwill of the other branches of the government and the public to accept it as legitimate. And if we keep having these huge fights and it seems partisan and this goes on, then people are going to say, well, do we have to listen to the Supreme Court? That's a dangerous thing.
Well, Carl, thank you so much
for joining us. Great to be here in Milwaukee.
Carl Hulse is the chief Washington correspondent of the New York Times, and he's the author of Confirmation Bias. He was in town for an event at the Marquette Law School, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. We'll take a short break and then return to meet the creators of NPR's White Lies podcast. It's now airing Fridays on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend returns with that in just a moment on WUWM. We are back with more of Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. In 1965, Reverend and activist James Reeb traveled from Boston, Massachusetts to Selma, Alabama to take part in the civil rights movement. He was murdered, dying of head injuries in the hospital 2 days after he was attacked. Three men were tried and acquitted, and no one was ever held to account. Now 50 years later, Alabama journalists Andrew Beck Grace and Chip Brantley returned to the city where it happened to expose the lies that kept the murder from being solved. However, what started as a mission to solve a cold civil rights case turned into a story about guilt and memory that says as much about the state of our country today as it does about the past. Their podcast, White Lies, is a 7-part special project from NPR's investigations team that seeks to break down the myths and mistruths that have surrounded the unsolved murder of Reverend Reeb. There's also a broadcast version of the podcast that you can hear Fridays on WUWM. Andrew Beck Grace and Chip Brantley joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about their experience curating the podcast.
Andrew Beck Grace and Chip Brantley, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for taking a few moments to speak with me today.
Thanks for having us. Yeah, it's good to be here.
Yeah, it's nice to be here.
So what prompted the both of you to take this deep dive into the unsolved murder of Reverend James Reeb?
Well, we are both based in Alabama. We are journalism professors, and the earlier part of this decade, Birmingham, where I'm from, and other places around Alabama and around the South were commemorating some of the 50th anniversaries of some of the major campaigns in the civil rights movement. And so Birmingham had just kind of gone through its 50th anniversary commemorations for the events of 1962 and 63. And in 2014, when we first took up the story, Selma was preparing to do the same with the events of the spring of 1965, of course, Bloody Sunday, and then the successful march from Selma to Montgomery. And so, you know, a lot of people were thinking about Selma. It was kind of in the air. A lot of these older stories were in the air. And so we kind of heard about this story from a reporter friend of ours, Jerry Mitchell, who's a kind of legendary civil rights cold case reporter in Mississippi. And in talking to Jerry, he suggested we look into the Reeb case. And so we started to look into it as not something we knew a lot about, even though we both grew up here. And as soon as we started reporting in Selma, we were immediately drawn to the story for reasons that we explore in the podcast.
You mentioned you grew up in Alabama, yet weren't too familiar. But when you take a deep dive and do talk to people who either experience it some way or their families had in generations before them, there is a lot of power of guilt and memory associated with this case, whether you're, quote, on either side.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the themes that we're really interested in exploring as white Southerners who have, I think, a pretty conscious awareness of the complicated history that we have in this country, but especially in the Deep South, and our hesitation for white people to talk about some of that difficult, the stuff that happened in the 60s, but for that matter, the legacy of slavery and the economic systems that came out of that time that still persist to this day in so many ways. There's a big reluctance, I think, on the part of many white Southerners to talk about this kind of stuff. And so we saw this story of what happened to James Reeb and whether or not we could really figure out, you know, not only who committed this murder, but how did this injustice of this trial resulting in an acquittal, how did that manifest itself and what did it mean for this city? We saw, I think, much deeper themes about the South and about our own collective memory in this one particular story.
Right. In an episode, you mentioned, quote, the white South again had declined another opportunity to come to terms with its conscience. And I found that statement really powerful. So do you think that stories like this and the issues that the South still faces today and the North and overall race relations in this country, that we need to keep talking about it because we are definitely not at a point where people are coming to terms with their conscience, whether it's decades in the past or today?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think we, you know, as we say in the show, we grew up in communities, white communities in Alabama, that just didn't at all grapple with these stories, which were not, you know, far in the past. Andy and I are both were born in the 70s, so we were born after the events of 1965 and in the civil rights movement proper. But our communities, these white communities we grew up in, were not grappling with this at all. It was the strategies we say in the show was silence. And so, you know, we really felt like, you know, part of our responsibility for this story was to get people to open up about what they knew about this particular story, what happened to Jim Reeb that night. And the window on all these old civil rights cold cases is closing, or maybe has closed, in terms of getting the truth from people who were participants or who witnessed these things. And so, you know, we really felt that the urge to get the people that we knew had some access to the story to tell us the truth.
Right. One thing I found really interesting and intriguing just as a journalist is the amount of research it took for you guys, you know, from hunting down records at a Dallas County jail and finding files in a formal janitor's closet. You know, were you even surprised yourselves, having done work like this in the past as journalists, about the places you had to dig in order to hunt down any primary documents related to this case?
Yeah, I mean, I think we had assumed, I think when we first started, well, again, the story kind of began for us when we were given this copy of an unredacted FBI file. And that made us think, probably naively now in retrospect, that there would be lots of records from this time period and lots of records of this particular case, which was historically important and people have written about it and et cetera, et cetera. And so started going down to Dallas County and talking to officials there, and there was just nothing. And they told us where we might look, and we were able to ingratiate ourselves with the clerks to kind of get into some of these spaces to look, like the Dallas County Jail and the Judicial Archives, which is basically a metal building behind the Enterprise Rent-A-Car on the way out of town. And so we went into these places and spent days going through these records. And really, there's a big hole in the history of Dallas County that revolves around the events of the 1960s. There was a prosecutor who was pretty legendary, a circuit judge who was pretty legendary. Obviously, the sheriff was very legendary. There were a number of federal lawsuits that happened against the city of Selma and Dallas County and these judicial officers basically during this time period. And so I think there was a lot of purging of those records, of anything that really talked about this time. The police files didn't exist, et cetera. And so I think we realized that the purging of those records was also tied to the bigger subtext of the story about this desire and this need to forget and not remember and to ignore the responsibility to the past.
Right. That is a recurring theme that comes up with this series, is your struggle to keep this past alive when people are saying, no, you need to move on. You know, how can this story help people see the value in keeping these stories alive, even if they're painful?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that has come out of doing this reporting and telling the story and talking to people who have listened to the story, who have opened up to us for the story, is that we would think a lot about, like, our responsibility to the story is to get to the truth about what happened to Jim Reeve. That is our sole purpose here in terms of the reporting, because that's something we feel like we can do. We can accomplish that. We weren't sure if we would be able to, but that's something we felt like we could do. We had a possibility of doing. And so I think that just the process of getting people to open up about it has helped us tell this definitive account about what happened. But we would often ask ourselves, like, is telling the truth enough? Is that enough to just sort of get the true version of events or what happened to Reeve? And we're not sure. As journalists, you know, it's kind of feel like the only thing we can do is tell the story, and then what the story does or doesn't do, or how people receive it and what they make of it and what they're inspired to do from hearing it, is in some ways beyond our control. But I do feel like that from what we have heard from listeners so far, at least about listening to the story, about something that a lot of people, I think, feel like they know this history or know something about this history, but to hear firsthand from people who were kind of small actors in the story is really important. And I think it's open. We've heard from a lot of listeners who feel like they have now the space to talk about what they experienced during this time and what they saw, what they participated in even. And so I think that's been, it's been gratifying for us to hear that. And I think that's kind of what we all need to do. I don't know that talking about it is the answer, but it's definitely better than not talking about it. It's a starting point.
Right. Who have the both of you met with for this series that has had the greatest impact on you personally?
That's a good question. I mean, when you report a story like this over the course of so many years, you really grow to, I don't know, become very close with a lot of people that you develop ties with. And I feel like for us, the Reeve family, who we really, for listeners who are, you know, listening to this for the first time, don't even make an appearance until the final episode of the show. But we did spend a good bit of time talking with them and visiting with them. They live out in Wyoming. And those relationships and finding the things we found and telling them about what we had found, I don't know, it's become a really special part of this story for us on a personal level. And then there are characters too, like Joanne Bland. I'll let Chip talk about that. But that's sort of people that we entered their orbits and they kind of changed us in really important ways.
So yeah, so Andy mentioned Joanne Bland, who is an African-American civil rights activist in Selma who gives civil rights tours of the city, who was actually 11 in 1965 and was on the bridge on Bloody Sunday with her sister, and has really spent most of her life trying to kind of make sense of that time and what's come after it, not only for herself, but for others who want to understand Selma, who want to understand the civil rights movement, who want to understand America. And so she was really an important guide for us as we reported this story. And then, you know, the other person that I think really touched both Andy and me was a guy named Clark Olson, who was one of the men who was with Jim Reeb that night when they were attacked, and who became very close to the Reeb family over the years, who died earlier this year. Clark did, but we both, spent a lot of time with him, talking to him about the story and how it shaped his life and how he himself had processed not only what happened to the three men that night, to him and to Orloff Miller and to Jim Reeb, but really processed how this story of what happened to them was told and what it wrought and how what happened to them and how the response to what happened to them, how that differed, from the news, for example, about what happened to Jimmie Lee Jackson, who was a black activist in Marion, Alabama. So Clark really, over the years, tried to process, again, not only what happened to him, but how their stories were kind of intertwined.
You guys have met with people who were part of both the attack on Reverend Reeb and also people involved in the civil rights, Reverend Reeb's family. All of this kind of connects on a base level what you hope would be sympathy, but how do you hope that this series can help people empathize with this story? What's your ultimate goal?
Well, I think we constructed the series with that a lot in mind. I mean, I think that a lot of these civil rights cold case stories, they get told in a very particular way, and that way is usually there is a victim who is a martyr, and that life that was taken was the thing that we foreground our sympathy and our empathy and the goodness of the person who was murdered, and that we are seeking to find the bad person who committed this murder. That's often how these stories operate. And I think we consciously wanted to evoke those structures that are familiar to people in terms of how the story works, but we wanted to also get away from the broader implications of that kind of story, which is that there's one good person and one bad person in this story. And the reality is that while Reeb was an incredible person, and we really don't spend a lot of time talking about him until the very end of the series. And while we do find out who murdered Reverend Reeb, we don't really try to say that the people who did it are the only guilty actors in the story. And I think that was very important and a very conscious decision that we made about the storytelling to make the blame for this murder more diffuse across a culture of complicity, basically. And so I think the hope for the entire series is that there will be a recognition of our listeners, in the same way that there was a recognition with Chip and I as we were reporting it, that the blame for this kind of injustice, it extends to communities which allow it to happen and perpetrate the lies that cover up the truth, and that we can all, even contemporarily, relate to what that feels like. So I think that was the sort of broader mission of the story.
Yeah, in an early episode of the show, we quote from Martin Luther King's eulogy of Jim Reeb, which he delivered in Selma a few days after he died. And in it, he says, you know, it's natural to focus, I'm paraphrasing here, but it's natural to focus on who killed Jim Reeb, but we also must ask the question, what killed Jim Reeb? And we really tried to keep that formulation in mind for the show. We definitely wanted to get to the bottom of what happened to Jim Reeb, who killed him, but in doing so, we also wanted to look at that broader question of what killed Jim Reeb, what underlying conditions contributed to his being there in the first place, and then his death, and then the cover-up of the crime that resulted in his death.
Well, Andrew Beck Grace and Chip Brantley, thank you both so much for your hard work in producing this series and for your time today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Journalists Andrew Beck Grace and Chip Brantley are the creators and co-hosts of the NPR podcast White Lies. They spoke with Audrey Nowakowski, and you can listen to the broadcast version, hosted by Morning Edition's Noel King, now airing on Fridays right here on WUWM. We'll take one last break and then meet first-time filmmaker Tracy Thomas. Her film, called My First and Last Film, is playing during the Milwaukee Film Festival. Lake Effect Weekend continues with that conversation in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us.
Tracy Thomas didn't want to be a filmmaker. The Milwaukee native never dreamed about having her name in lights. But about 5 years ago, she was about to turn 60 and was feeling at loose ends. So she started interviewing other people who were about to turn 60 or who already had about what it felt like. And the idea of turning those interviews into the 60 Project was born. She started working with her boyfriend, Dennis, who was a professional filmmaker. And things were going along really well until Dennis got really sick, and then he died suddenly about a year in. Everything in her life profoundly changed. Thomas found that the 60 Project film was changing, too. The finished film, now called My First and Last Film, premiered in Wisconsin last week at the Rivoli Theater. It was part of this year's Milwaukee Film Festival. Thomas joins me now in the studio to talk about her movie's journey. Tracy Thomas, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Bonnie. I appreciate you letting me come on and talk about my film.
Well, and congratulations.
Thank you.
On it, your first and last film.
Yes.
And what I loved about the film, it was very gentle. There was just sort of, you know, sort of this beautiful sense of, you know, what death is, what friendships are, what getting older means. And it all sort of unfolded in a way that I don't think you were expecting, because it was not how you had planned to do the film.
First of all, thank you for those wonderful comments. That means a lot, because those are words I haven't heard before when some people that have seen the film have said. So I appreciate those comments. Correct. This did not go the direction it was going to go, although I must say, when Dennis and I were working on it, we really didn't have a direction. Every day we would do interviews and we would look at the footage at the end of the day. We'd say, oh, the film could go this way, it could go that way. So, and then he passed away. So he and I never had a chance to even get a solid direction. So it kind of went the way that you saw it. It kind of unfolded in that way. It got more and more personal than we had intended it was going to get.
Yeah, I mean, I got that sense as I was watching it, because it became much more about you.
Yes.
And your experience, even though it started, we should probably start with where you were planning to start it, which was turning 60. It was the 60 Project. So talking to people here and other places about what it feels like to either be about to turn 60 or have already turned 60 and what that meant.
Right.
And of course, I find that fascinating, because that's exactly where I am, you know, and it's an interesting place to be, as all of your subjects proved, you know, talking about what that means and how your life has changed and how your expectations shift.
And what's next and what do I do now?
Right.
And is anybody else kind of feeling the same way I am? I was kind of looking for answers, I guess. So,
because you were about to turn 60 when you started this, right?
I had already turned 60.
Okay.
I turned 60 in 2014. And then a girlfriend of mine, because I was dating Dennis, who is a filmmaker, she got the idea, why don't you make a film about women in the older women in the workforce trying to get jobs? And that's so difficult now. And I kind of went, I don't know. So I sat on that for about a year. And then Dennis and I were kind of apart. So I came to him with the idea and said, what about we do a film about men and women turning 60, and I'm still kind of freaking out about it, and it's kind of a big number. And so he said, that's a great idea. So that's kind of how that part unfolded.
But you had never planned to be a filmmaker.
Not at all.
Yeah.
No.
Was that a 60 thing? Like, I'm going to do something I had never done before?
No, I think it was the girlfriend putting the bug in my ear and dating a filmmaker and perhaps trying to get Dennis back, all those things combined. So, but yeah, no, someone asked me that the other day. Did you always want to be a filmmaker? Not in one iota. No, I like film. I enjoy going to films, but it's not a thing in my wheelhouse.
So what is in your wheelhouse?
Right now, I'm kind of concentrating on what's happening in the moment, is getting this film out there and getting people to see it, and I just kind of want to get through the film festival circuit and kind of see where the film takes us. We may want to kind of tour it around to art house theaters and maybe universities and women's groups and Q&As and talks and things like that. But so that's kind of over the next year. But I really have no commitment to any plans. Kind of just want to see where this all takes me. I'm kind of open to whatever happens.
Well, I got the sense of you in the film that there was a lot of you know, you get to 60, you've done a lot of living by the time we're all 60, and that you had all of these other interests and things, but stuff had kind of gelled maybe because of the circumstances of this.
Things change. My sister had passed away, Dennis passed away, my mom passed away, all within about 6 years of each other. So you kind of stop and take stock of your life and kind of do some reflecting, which is what I did. I like to volunteer, so I stopped all volunteering, and you just can take a look at your life and see what you want to do. So I kind of was doing that for a few years and then started making the film. So the film is a great experience, actually. So that I think making the film actually helped me to do some healing and more looking inward, that kind of a thing. Pretty cathartic, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It felt like you were able to grieve throughout the course of the film as the film progressed.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Because there was a hiatus of about 1.5, 2 years when Dennis and I were making it, and then he passed away and then I started again. There's a 2-year span in there. And yeah, I was not emotionally ready to pick it up again. Then all of a sudden it's like, you know, it's been nagging at me. I need to get it going. So one foot in front of the other, as I said to someone the other day, baby steps, teeny tiny baby steps, and just moving forward. And so I believe it was, and I only realized it was cathartic probably in the last couple of weeks as people are seeing the film and I'm being interviewed and I'm talking about it more. It's like, oh, I guess it was kind of healing. How about that? You don't know it when you're going through it because it's pretty brutal in spots. So
yeah, there were some points in the film that I really felt it. I could feel it in you. I felt like I wanted to reach in and give you a hug and say, it's okay. You'll get through it. It's okay.
Oh, that's lovely. And that's, well, thank you. Yeah, it was pretty tough in some spots and some scenes, and even just watching it myself now, and it's like I cry at certain spots still. So it doesn't get much easier just to kind of relive all that again. But yeah. It's quite a process.
Do you think Dennis would have loved the film?
I hope so. That's a really hard question. That's, well, I'm just going to say yes.
Yeah.
Because he better love it. He better love it. I think he would, though. I think he'd be proud of me.
Yeah, I would think so, too, particularly since you have no filmmaking background. And he was the professional. He was the one who had done it all his life. And, you know, to see what you've come up with on your own, essentially.
Yeah, with the help of my fantastic crew. But yes, and when I was working with him, he said, well, this is your film. And I'm like, I'm thinking, well, it's kind of our film. And he goes, no, it's your film. Because I came to him with the idea. So he gave me the reins. He didn't treat me like I was green at it or inexperienced. He just, you know, would give me advice. We talk about things. And he acted like I was, this is it. This is yours. So, and that's how my current crew, they're like, no, this is your film. I'm like, it is? It took me a while to kind of accept that.
To own it.
To own it. To completely own it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I'm getting there. I'm still getting there.
Yeah.
Still getting there.
It's yours. I got to tell you, Tracy, it's yours.
It's out there. It's out there.
It's got your name on it.
I know. It's pretty scary, let me tell you.
Do you think it's changed the way you personally think about aging?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
I really do. Because when I first started out, like I say, it was like almost 5 years ago, and not feeling the 60 thing. You know, like, okay, now we're on the other side. 40, 50 is cool. On the other side of that, more past than future, as Dennis would have said. And so not just kind of in my own little funk about it. So but over the last 5 years, for sure, doing the interviews and how those people, if you probably saw some of the interviews, and many of them are like, no, not a big deal. And it's like, everything's cool and I can be myself. And that's true. So just working on the film with my crew, looking at the interviews, and form my own opinions that age is just a number, and it's how you look at life and your attitude towards it. And
there was somebody, and I'm not going to remember which of your interviewees it was, but was talking about that, and was saying that it's how you, like, yes, your body ages, you can't change that,
yeah,
but that it's how you resist the narrowing of perspective.
Oh, yes. He was a great interviewer.
Oh, my God. He was wonderful.
He was fantastic. And he was the one, when I was interviewing people, it's like, doesn't anybody feel the way I do, kind of in a funk and sad and nervous about it? And then Babo, he was kind of one of the ones that was like, kind of felt the way I did. And like, yeah, it's you become, you're narrow. It's, you got to open up. You got to be open to the changes that are coming in. Yeah, you have to remain open. And if you are constantly thinking about the number, whatever age you are, you're going to be locked into that. And we tend to think, hey, 60, 70, we're old and yeah, life's over. Well, you can certainly think that. I think it's what you do with that time. And if you make the most of that time, I don't know, I think you'll be okay.
Yeah.
If you get locked into that number, you're never going to be able to move forward or enjoy life. You're always going to be worried about, oh my God, what's going to happen? Which is where I was about 5-6 years ago.
So the film really had the catharsis.
Yeah, I think so, right. I mean, I didn't realize it, like I said earlier, until like a few weeks ago. It's like, okay.
Yeah, and I think sometimes you get in those situations where you don't even know what road you're on until you're off it and you go,
correct.
I was on that? Really?
Right.
Wow.
There was transformation happening without me even being aware of it because you're busy making a film and you're going to meetings and you're deciding things and you're going on location and you're doing all that you do to make a film. So you're not constantly going, wow, that was a transformational day. You know, it's not. I mean,
most people don't in real life. I mean, you
don't.
You're not that self-aware usually.
We're pretty self-obsessed at times, but yeah, we're not that self-aware that we are so cool. Like, I got that. Today is an awesome day. I transformed.
Wow, I had my moment. Yeah.
I had my moment. Once in a while, there's that moment where you think everything's clicking and everything. My life is awesome. But yeah, that's that kind of transformation, grieving and getting through these difficult shoots. It's like, oh, my God, no, that's not.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware.
And sometimes you find yourself at the end of a particular period of time and you realize you've changed and you didn't know it was happening.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
No. It's a good thing.
I hope that the discussions around this, you know, around your film and where you take it, center on some of that, on what we're talking about right now, the idea that, you know, life doesn't end.
Right.
Until it does.
Until it does. Exactly.
Right. It's like
you're not dead until you're dead.
Right. Yeah, there's no.
That's pretty basic.
There's
but
kind of no in between for most of us. You know,
correct.
It's like either you're not or you are. And
right.
And while you're not, there's a lot to do. Well, whatever that is.
Then that's brilliant. While you're not, right? And we're not. We're here. We're living. We're doing things. We're communicating. We're spending time with our families, and we're taking out the garbage, and you know, all that stuff. Yeah. I mean, it's all of it is pretty much a gift.
Yeah.
That is denied to a lot of people. I know that's a cliche, but it's true. Some people don't get to age, like Dennis and other people in my life. So, right.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty lucky, if you think about it. Wow.
Yeah. And would you have ever thought you would have said that 5 or 6 years ago?
No. I'm a pretty positive person in general. But, yeah, 5 years ago, and no, I wouldn't have. I was kind of looking, you know, down on it. But now today, it's like the gratitude in me is like as big as this room or this building. It's I'm grateful for this whole journey and the people that have helped me get through it and can't even tell you.
So what do you think is next for you once you're done with the juggernaut of getting the film out to audiences?
No, I don't know. I was thinking about that last night. I don't, like I said earlier, I don't think I have any big plans. I just kind of want to get through this and travel is on my list. And I think traveling with the film festival will be a good start for places to meet, for me to see as far as I like them and want to go back to them. And I don't know. Meeting people is awesome. And I kind of want to see if some other kind of project will spawn from this. Maybe help produce someone else's film or women's issues or groups or I don't know. So, you know, the sky's the limit, right?
Which is fabulous.
What is fabulous? I mean, seriously, it should be the limit for everybody.
But we very often refrain or push ourselves down or tell ourselves that's not possible.
Correct.
You know, and I think maybe for me, one of the most positive and powerful things of this film, which is both funny and very sad, it's got all of those things mixed up very profound, is that, you know, it is possible. You can move and change and you should embrace that.
Exactly. And that's very well said. And that's what I want this movie to convey to people is of any age, you can really do anything you want. You can certainly try. And if you don't like it, okay, I don't like that. Try something else. Okay, that didn't work. I'm not good at that. Whatever. Just, you know, be brave. Be brave in your life. And I think as you get older, we tend to, as Baba said, we tend to stay closed because we are afraid to try things like, or it's too late. You know, I don't need to do that. I've done all.
I'm going to make a fool of myself.
Fool of myself. All kinds of things. Right. So, well, people will look at me funny or people will say, don't do that. Or, yeah, you know, be your own person and be brave. And I don't know. I'm going to say that a lot in the next couple of days. So,
yeah. Brave.
Be brave.
Yeah. And be open.
Yeah. I think if you remain open, And I've been telling people as well, I don't feel like I have any fears anymore because I've done this film and I really put myself out there. So I don't feel like I'm afraid of a whole lot anymore.
That's fantastic.
It's liberating and just kind of wonderful, actually.
And, you know, I think turning 60 helps with that.
I think so, too.
I think we just don't care. You know, at least it's not that you don't care. It's that you don't have time for the nonsense.
Right.
You just kind of go, I'm not going to worry about that.
You put importance on other things.
Right.
You put that weight on other things right. that mean more. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Well, Tracy Thomas, I wish you the best with the film. And, of course, with whatever else you do next, whatever that happens to be, come and talk to us about it.
I absolutely will. Thank you so much, Bonnie. I really appreciate you having me on.
Milwaukee first-time filmmaker Tracy Thomas's movie, My First and Last Film, had its Wisconsin premiere last week at the Milwaukee Film Festival. It has one more showing Tuesday evening at the Oriental Theater. There's a link to a complete film festival schedule at WUWM.com. And that wraps up our show today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.